We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Rehmer on July 11th, 2023. Today, Angela Comfort reports on patient outcomes at the intersection of the social determinants of health and the CMS star rating quality measures. We'll get the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Dr. Juliette Ugarte-Hopkins discusses physician documentation. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Rehmer presents her talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man who surprised everyone last week when he announced he'd be celebrating Independence Day at the beach wearing his birthday suit, Chuck Buck.
Yeah, and it was chilly too, Clark. Thanks, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 560th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and good morning, Erica.
I'm a little shocked, Clark. Good morning, Chuck. Everyone had a great 4th of July, except for you, Chuck, I think.
Yeah, it was chilly, everyone. Actually. Yeah, good morning. You know, as you heard Clark Anthony announce, Angela Comfort is our special guest this morning. And by way of reintroduction, folks, Angie Comfort was almost a permanent panelist on Talk 10 Tuesday. That was during the run-up to ICD-10. Today, she is a big-time senior consultant for E4 Services, and she's also a CDI transformational leader at Montefiore Health. We're delighted to have Angie on our program.
Yep. Welcome to Angie. I will be fascinated to hear what she has to say about SDOH and quality.
Yeah, indeed. So, Erica, what are you going to be saying during your talkback segment today?
I am going to be finishing up my review of second quarter coding clinic.
Very good. Well, we're looking forward to your talkback segment, as we always do. Folks, we have a lot of news to report, so we begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Good morning, Chuck. And this is more about hospitals than coding, but it was an important thing. So today I wanted to talk about CMS flip-flopping on rural reclasses in the rural floor. So in 2019, Medicare released the following statements. It appears the hospitals in a limited number of states have been using urban to rural hospital reclassifications to inappropriately influence the rural floor wage index. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services at the time released a fact sheet on this. And to address the unanticipated effects of rural reclassifications on this rural floor, resulting in wage index disparities, CMS said that at the time that they're going to remove urban to rural hospital reclassifications from computing the rural floor wage index beginning in fiscal year 2020. Following recent public feedback, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is considered flip-flopping on its wage index policies. These changes would affect hospitals that have transitioned from urban to rural reclassifications, according to Section 1886 D8E of the Social Security Act, as implemented in regulations under Sections 412.103. In response to this feedback, and after revisiting relevant court rulings and filings and the statute itself, CMS is proposing a reinterpretation of this section. And under this new interpretation, hospitals that have reclassified to rural will be treated identically again to inherently rural hospitals when calculating wage index. The proposed change, intended to be implemented from fiscal year 2024 onward, would mean the hospitals that were reclassified under Section 412.103 would be included in the wage index calculations alongside geographically rural hospitals. Consequently, the data from all hospitals classified under Section 412.103 would continue to the wage index calculations for the state's rural area and also the wage index floor for the state's urban hospitals. So under existing law, the wage index for hospitals in an urban area cannot be lower than the wage index for hospitals in rural areas of the same state. This is a provision known as the rural floor, and the proposed changes would uphold this rule. Since the wage index is a zero-sum game, winners would include urban hospitals with low wage indexes that will see a rise in the rural floor. Losers then will include urban hospitals that do not reclassify if the average hourly wage then MSA falls when the reclassified hospitals are removed from that MSA. We should remember that most hospitals doing urban to rural reclassifications did it only to increase their indirect medical education payments, and that the increase in these payments exceeded the reduction in the wage index. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks, Jim, very much. That was Jim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. Folks, it is Tuesday. It's July the 11th, and you're listening to the 560th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
For coding professionals, it's crucial to have a clear understanding of patient safety indicators, hospital-acquired conditions, and present on admission status guidelines. This helps with accurate code assignment and avoids inaccurate reporting. During an upcoming webcast, you'll learn about patient safety indicators with a focus on trouble spots, like foreign bodies left during surgery and postoperative respiratory failure. You will see key terms to watch for in medical record documentation to ensure proper coding and identify the need for documentation clarification. You will also learn to exclude irrelevant conditions that don't meet coding guidelines. Best of all, you'll learn to identify documentation improvement opportunities and collaborate with clinical documentation integrity specialists and providers to enhance quality of care. That webcast is this Thursday, July 13th. Register now to attend.
Now it's time for the Talk to Intuitive Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, released the fiscal year 24 ICD-10-CM guidelines on July 5th. The guidelines can be found on the CDC's ICD-10 website or Medicare's 2024 ICD-10-CM website. There are 120 pages in the updated guidelines. For the most part, there are minor changes to the guidelines with code updates based on ICD-10-CM changes. There is one new guideline in Chapter 9, which is the circulatory system, which is titled Myocardial Infarction with Coronary Microvascular Dysfunction. This guideline states, coronary microvascular dysfunction is a condition that impacts the microvasculature by restricting microvascular flow and increasing microvascular resistance. Code I21.B is assigned for myocardial infarction with coronary microvascular disease, myocardial infarction with coronary microvascular dysfunction, or myocardial infarction with non-obstructive coronary arteries, or MINOCA, with microvascular disease. There are two other big changes. Under Chapter 1, the guideline for screening for COVID has been updated for the end of the pandemic. Effective October 1st, 2023, the code for screening for COVID will be Z11.52. You should continue to report Z20.822 for COVID screening until October 1st visits or discharges. It is important to continue to report the COVID screenings to continue to receive the additional monies. Another big change, which may be overlooked, but has implication for coding and CDI, under Section 3, reporting additional diagnoses, the definition has been updated to include clinically significant. I interpret this change that the documentation must be clear that the reported diagnosis has impacted the current stay. In other words, if there is any doubt regarding the secondary diagnosis impacting the patient's stay, then a query needs to be issued. One last thing is that there's no changes in present on admission reporting. The guidelines are developed and approved by the cooperating parties, which include American Hospital Association, American Health Information Management Association, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and the National Center of Health Statistics, a division of the CDC. There is more information on the guideline changes in my article on ICD-10monitor.com. And with that, Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. It's nice to know that Minoka got its own code now. Thank you, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thank you, Erica. And Lori Johnson, thanks very much. Be sure to read her excellent article. It's in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor. Every Tuesday at this time, we have the Talk to Tuesday report on the social determinants of health. except for this morning. So substituting this morning for Tiffany Ferguson is Dr. Julia Ugarte-Hopkins. And good morning, Dr. Ugarte-Hopkins. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's good to be here. Thanks, Chuck. When I was a medical student in the late 90s, one of my attendings sectioned off a third of the sheet of paper in the medical record before me and instructed my nose could not be larger than that area. Overwhelmed with a desire to capture every point about the patient's story and condition, which I considered of interest, I proceeded to write in tiny text so two lines fit into every one printed on the line paper. While this memory makes me chuckle, it also reminds me of one reason why we continue to have such an issue with inadequate provider notes. Back in the day, if you'll recall, brevity in medical documentation was practically a badge of honor. You'll be hard-pressed to find a physician between the ages of 40 and 80 who doesn't remember at least one, quote, legend who kept a Rolodex in their clinic office with a single index card per patient. Not per patient encounter, per patient. And let's be honest, who hasn't rolled their eyes at a hospital surgical note, which is a single sentence long? Documentation started out as a record of patient condition for the documenters themselves, reminders of what they saw and addressed the visit before. With the rise of subspecialization and a team approach to medicine, office and hospital notes evolved into a type of communication using abbreviations and symbols, which actually required special education to decipher. At the time, passing information between practitioners was of primary importance and the main reason for documentation. Everyone was on the same page, literally, before the development of electronic health records, and was kept in the loop with the plan for the patient. With the purpose of documentation melded into the support behind reimbursement and quality monitoring, no one really explained this shift to the doctors and other providers. I stopped practicing clinically in 2014, and it was about a year before that when someone in my, when my whole group of pediatric hospitalists first spoke with someone, quote, in the billing department about specificity of documentation for patients with asthma and avoiding the term urosepsis. What was the reasoning behind this direction? To make sure the documentation is as specific as it can be. As you might expect, my colleagues and I were unimpressed. In fact, I didn't understand what was really being said until after I became a physician advisor working closely with utilization management and clinical documentation integrity teams. Why? Because no one took the message down to brass tacks. Provider terms do not equate to coding terms. And without proper coding, there's no proper payment to the hospital. Without proper payment to the hospital, services our patients need can't be afforded. Without the ability to provide services our patients need, they would divert elsewhere, and ultimately, the hospital will close. And we haven't even touched on quality and things like expected length of stay and outcomes. My hope is that within the last 10 years, the message about clinical documentation integrity has grown more to the point. But I know the reality involves a continuation of many, many doctors across the country not understanding why they are being asked to beef up their documentation. Stay tuned for my upcoming article in ICD-10 Monitor to learn the most succinct ways to teach and make it stick. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Juliet. You know, it's funny. Just yesterday, I saw this quote by either Blaise Pascal or Mark Twain, and it was, I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one instead. And that reminds me of what you just said to us. Thanks, Juliet. That was Dr. Juliet Ugarte-Hopkins. She's the president of the American College of Physician Advisors and my good friend.
When your team is faced with a tight budget, the folks at MedLearn are here to help. Introducing the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Keep your team trained and in the know with this web-based platform created to help you make an impact on your revenue without breaking the bank, so you can focus on what matters most, patient outcomes. For a single low annual subscription rate, all your teams will have convenient one-stop access to the complete libraries of three trusted brands, MedLearn Publishing, ICD-10 Monitor, and Rack Monitor. One low monthly cost, unlimited access, and all the CEUs you need. It's the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Increase your knowledge with workable coding solutions and actionable answers with the MedLearn Media Resource Center.
Our lead story this morning is about what's happening at the intersection of ICD-10-CM, Social Determinants of Health Codes, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Star Rating Quality Measures. Well, there's plenty happening, and all of that is going to impact patient outcomes and ratings. Here now with the details is a longtime friend of this broadcast, Angela Comfort.
Good morning, Angie. Welcome to the broadcast.
Good morning, Chuck, and thank you for having me again. It's just a pleasure to be here. So let's begin by defining the two key elements of the topic. The social determinants of health, or SDOH, is a lot of times what we see in the charts. And as established by the World Health Organization, are the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. And these conditions can greatly influence people's health, their quality of life, and their lifespan. They include factors like their socioeconomic status, education, the physical environment, and their actual neighborhood that they live in, employment status, and social support networks, as well as their access to healthcare. And a lot of times there is limited access to healthcare for these individuals. On the other hand, the star rating quality measures by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, is a system designed to measure the quality of the healthcare services provided by hospitals and health plans. These ratings take into account factors such as health outcomes, access to care, and the beneficiary satisfaction. The intersection of these two elements is very crucial. The CMS star ratings not only impact the quality and type of care that the patients receive, but it also impacts the reimbursement rates for the care providers. What becomes clear is that the social determinants of health can dramatically influence these star ratings. For instance, let's consider access to transportation, which is a typical SDOH. In areas with poor public transportation or in rural regions where medical facilities are kind of few and far between, patients may find it challenging to attend regular checkups or receive necessary treatments for their chronic diseases. This lack of access to care can directly impact several of the star rating measures, such as preventative care and chronic disease management, which result in lower star ratings. Similarly, consider another SDOH, the educational level. Research has shown a correlation between lower education and poor health outcomes. Less education can translate into less understanding of medical information. And we all know how confusing medical information from our doctors and their instructions can be. But this can lead to poor adherence to prescribed treatments and then worse outcomes. This in turn can negatively also affect that star rating based on the outcomes, as well as how the patient is feeling about being satisfied with their treatment. However, it's important to note that the CMS has increasingly recognized the impact of SDOH on health outcomes and patient satisfaction. In recent years, the CMS has made efforts to incorporate the SDOH codes into their models, considering factors like income, education, and the environment. It's a promising step toward addressing these critical influences on health. One such potential effort is the significant change announced in the fiscal year 2024 IPPS draft rule. In the draft rule, the CMS has made an important advancement by including SDOH codes for homelessness, which will be classified as a CC, complication or comorbidity, if that draft rule makes it to final, which is usually sometime in early August. We have three codes that are specific for homelessness: Z5900, which is unspecified homelessness, Z5901, sheltered homelessness, and Z5902 for unsheltered homelessness. The inclusion of the codes means that healthcare providers will now be financially incentivized to screen for and document homelessness. It's a huge stride towards understanding and addressing the impact of homelessness on health outcomes. Homelessness is a profound social determinant of health. It's associated with a range of health issues, mental disorders, chronic diseases, and increasingly higher mortality rates. Homeless individuals often face those barriers to access quality health care, which further exacerbates their chronic conditions. However, with the new IPPS draft rule, providers can now get reimbursed for that extra care that these individuals require. For example, a homeless person might need more time, resources, or specialized interventions to manage that chronic condition compared to a housed individual. Now, the CMS recognizes these challenges and is compensating providers accordingly. Moreover, this change also helps elevate the visibility of homelessness as a health issue. Providers are now encouraged to document homelessness, contributing it to a richer data set for researchers and policymakers. This data will be critical in understanding the true impact of homelessness on health and how the health system can better serve this vulnerable population. This shift in the CMS's approach is a significant indication of the growing recognition of the role of social determinants of health in shaping our health outcomes. By financially recognizing that the additional complexity associated with caring for these individuals, CMS is setting a precedent for how we can make our healthcare system more sensitive to SDOH, driving us towards a future where we can provide comprehensive, accessible, and equitable care for all. However, still more can be done. Health systems and payers must find ways to mitigate the impact of social determinants on health outcomes. This could include innovative solutions, such as partnerships with community organizations, investments in social services, and adoption of technology to reach those patients who might be physically distant from care. In conclusion, the intersection of social determinants of health and the CMS star ratings is a vital issue. Ignoring the profound influence of SDOH can result in lower star ratings, potentially affecting the quality of care that patients receive. Recognizing and addressing these determinants, therefore, is crucial, not just for maintaining high-quality services, but for ensuring equitable care for all, regardless of their circumstances. Erica, back over to you.
Thanks, Angie. That was Angela Comfort. She's a senior consultant for E4 Services and CDI Transformational Leader at Montefiore Health System.
Now, with our very popular segment here at Talk to Enthusiasts called Talk Back and Features Your Own, Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. Today I'm going to go over what I picked up from the American Hospital Association's Coding Clinic Q2. It was chock full of interesting advice. 2 weeks ago, I went over COVID-19 screening, as Lori did a little bit today as well. I think Coding Clinic should have explained why we continue to use Z20.822, contact with and suspected exposure to COVID-19, after May 11th, instead of just noting, quote, "This advice is consistent with current coding guidance," close quote. In theory, once there is no longer an epidemic or pandemic situation, we should be using contact with and suspected exposure only when we recognize that this is the probable scenario. In practice, they are setting the timeline as the end of the fiscal year in which the pandemic ended, that is 2023. I learned a new code in my review. There is a code R97.21, rising PSA following treatment for malignant neoplasm of prostate. The question asked how to code biochemically recurrent prostate cancer post-prostatectomy and salvage radiation therapy. The answer indicated that since the prostate had been resected, the culprit has to be a metastasis. And since the site is unknown, you use C79.9, secondary malignant neoplasm of unspecified site. My new code is also used because that is how they diagnosed it. That's what biochemically recurrent means. A question was posed regarding a patient getting a workup for a suspected malignancy and an excisional biopsy of a supraclavicular lymph node revealing metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. The question related to the sequencing of the primary and secondary malignancies. Although the procedure is ostensibly linked to the secondary malignancy, the primary malignancy is the condition responsible for both the metastasis and the overall workup hospital admission. The response is to sequence the primary lung cancer as principal diagnosis. One should only sequence metastasis as principal diagnosis if it is the only focus for diagnostic or therapeutic treatment. Another interesting question was asked about venous thoracic outlet syndrome causing left upper extremity swelling and acute left subclavian deep vein thrombosis. the indexing led to G54.0, brachial plexus disorders. But the questioner proposed I87.1, compression of vein, as a more accurate clinical representation. The reviewer agreed that since the pathology involved the vein, not nerves, further research should lead the coder to I87.1. To my clinician brain, compression usually indicates external forces impacting on the anatomy, like a tumor pressing on the trachea. However, ICD-10-CM indexes kink, obstruction, stenosis, and stricture to, quote, compression of vein, close quote, to. On page 10, there is a question about a patient with pre-existing type 2 diabetes presenting with hyperglycemia believed to be secondary to autoimmune diabetes after initiation of immunotherapy medication. The answer was to use only E11.65 type 2 diabetes with hyperglycemia and T45.1X5A, adverse effect of antineoplastic and immunosuppressive drugs initial encounter for the exacerbation of the disorder of sugar metabolism. My brain went, where would you go if there were no underlying pre-existing type 2 diabetes? In that case, the diabetes code should be E09.65, drug or chemical-induced diabetes mellitus with hyperglycemia. Page 15 asks a question about a post-abortion complication. A patient presents for an elective termination of pregnancy due to a genetic abnormality and sustains uterine atony and hemorrhage. If there were a post-abortion code analogous to 072.1, other immediate postpartum hemorrhage, that would be the right choice. However, since there is not, the advice is to use 04.6, delayed or excessive hemorrhage following, in parenthesis, induced termination of pregnancy, plus the code for the maternal care for the chromosomal abnormality. Currently, there is an excludes one note at 004, precluding concomitant use of Z33.2 encounter for elective termination of pregnancy, but this will become an excludes to October 1st, 2023. For this particular code, it makes sense because excessive hemorrhage could occur at the time of the encounter for the termination or could be delayed until a subsequent encounter. My final comment is that the reason why linkage is assumed resulting in the quote with close quote guidance is that the conditions with the assumed causal relationship are commonly associated, not because ICD-10-CM classification mandates it. It's the other way around. ICD-10-CM acknowledges the near inevitable relationship between, for instance, hypertension and heart failure or diabetes and chronic kidney disease by assuming causality unless specified otherwise. The words, quote, due to, close quote, do establish relationship if the provider documents them, such as hypertension due to hyperthyroidism would go to I15.2, hypertension secondary to endocrine disorders. Please review the COVID clinic, the coding clinic guidance yourself. There are more nuggets to collect. And I'd like to extend an invitation to all to join me on LinkedIn on Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern for my next Ask Dr. Reamer. You can find the link on my company page, Erica Reamer, MD, Inc. Hope to see you all then. Chuck, back to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. That was an excellent topic for your TalkBack segment, and we appreciate it very much. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of TalkTen Tuesday. It's our 560th live edition. And I want to thank our panelists today, Lori Johnson, Tim Powell, Dr. Julia Dugarte-Hopkins. She was substituting this morning for Timothy Ferguson. Angie Comfort, who reported our lead story. Angie, it was great to have you on our program, and a very special thanks to you, my dear friend, Dr. Erica Reamer, who co-hosts this broadcast every Tuesday. And remember, if you can't listen to us live, you can always listen to us on Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, give us a review. Until we meet again next Tuesday, July 18th, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor, and talk to you Tuesday. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and have a great week.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.